HD Smartcast.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
You're listening to On the Record with me, Sunetra Chaudhary.
And our guest today is former Foreign Secretary Nirupama Rao Menon, who has a new book out. It's called The Fractured Himalayas, and it looks at the backdrop and the history of the relationship between India, Tibet, and China. It is a complicated history, and it is very, very relevant right now because of the border standoff that we are witnessing at the LAC for the last year and a half. So to talk more about her book, and by talking about her book, to give us perspective on what is happening right now, I welcome Nirupama Rao Menon here on the record. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Sunetra. Very happy to be here.
So I want to start by asking you, just the whole timing of it, is it that, did you start writing this book during the pandemic, and was the situation which started around April, May last year with China, is that what prompted you to write down the backdrop and the history of these two countries?
Well, Sunetra, I think the fact of the confrontation along the line of actual control in eastern Ladakh and all the events that you saw unfolding from the summer of 2020 accelerated, let me say, the process of completion of the book. Actually, I had started writing it about 4 years ago because, as you know, there must have seen from the book, there was a lot of research involved in putting this whole narrative together. And I had, you know, proceeded along at the usual pace. I had so much on my plate and there were so many other preoccupations that kept me distracted and prevented me from finishing the book. But once the lockdown was in place, I think there was an enforced sense of discipline that enabled me to complete the book. And my family certainly kept me on track, saying that you have to finish it. And I kind of just hunkered down and completed the manuscript by the beginning of this year. And after that, of course, you know, you go through the whole process of proofreading and editing. And then I had to add the maps and the bibliography and the notes. So it took its own time. But there it is now. And I have the book in my hand. It's with me.
No, it's fascinating, especially because you know, someone like me who's not a China expert, you, of course, are. You were posted there as ambassador as well. You retired as foreign secretary in 2011. And it's fascinating to get some of the nuances of the relationship. Now, what I wanted to ask you was what, you know, we've known, because it keeps coming up again and again as well, especially because people have been talking so much about it ever since the standoff with China. This entire, you know, topic of Prime Minister Nehru's miscalculation when it came to China. You deal with it as well. But what is the, it's an issue which has been talked about so much. What was your objective when you started writing about this thing?
Well, Sunetra, my objective really was to inform a young generation of Indians about the very nuanced and complex nature of this entire narrative, because it's very interesting and very obvious that with the benefit of hindsight that everybody has 20/20 vision. But what I tried to demonstrate through writing this book is that hindsight is never, you know, fully accurate. And you have to place yourself in the context of those developments, those events, and what the leaders and what the policymakers were faced with, the kind of challenges they were faced with when making these decisions. So I've tried to offer a more nuanced narrative. And I've also tried to underline that while, you know, it's usually the textbook gospel of many to blame Nehru for everything that went wrong with China, I've tried to say that, you know, it was not as if Nehru was not aware of the dangers and the risks and the pitfalls of dealing with this big neighbor next door, this big neighbor that had come up against us in the Himalayas. As you know, when the Chinese entered Tibet, it was famously said by one of our officials who was posted in Lhasa, Sumul Sinha, that the Chinese have entered Tibet and the Himalayas no longer exist. I think to some extent, Nehru was also aware of that. He was aware that the basic challenge that runs across the spine of Asia is the challenge between India and China. And he said as much when he met an Indian delegation that was going to China in 1952, when he had a briefing meeting with them. So he understood the nature of the challenge, but at the same time, I think he was also quite focused on the need for a peaceful environment in which India could develop and India could consolidate its neighborhood. And therefore, he felt that friendship with China, that dialogue with China, that some kind of understanding with China. Here you would have these two big countries, the big two of Asia, working together, and that they could be a third force in world politics, and that would redound to India's benefit. Now, as it turned out, he was proved wrong in his calculations about China. But I've tried to emphasize in the book that he was concerned about security along India's frontiers, and he really was the one who took the decisions to consolidate our administration closer to the Himalayan borders, extend connectivity, improve infrastructure. So blaming Nehru may not entirely solve the problem for us, or at least put us at ease in understanding what happened.
I completely get that. And I see the kind of nuance you brought in, especially when, you know, when Chinese moved into Tibet at that time, how Nehru, despite the fact that people felt that he was soft on them, that how he talked about and stressed on the need for maintaining Tibet's autonomy. But what I think perhaps where the cliche or where the kind of general perception in your book is proved right, perhaps, is the kind of difference between how Sardar Patel, the deputy prime minister, and the home minister at the time, how he saw the Chinese as a threat, and the difference between him and Nehru on that. And I found it fascinating, as you reveal in your book, that he had that Patel had these secret meetings with the head of the intelligence.
Yes, Sardar Patel, I believe, had an aversion for communism, and he distrusted communist China, and he did not see any good coming about with the Chinese entry into Tibet. You're right about that. And I think to a large extent, Nehru understood that also subconsciously. The second point that I'd like to make is that, Sardar Patel unfortunately passed away in December 1950. So he was not around when a lot of the decisions in regard to China policy were taken subsequently. So we really don't know how things would have played out if he had lived and if he had been an important constituent, an important force in the making of our policy towards China. So, at this moment, I can't conjecture about what might have happened if he had lived. But let me add that from my research and from my study of the papers, it was very clear that from 1949 onwards, Nehru was worried about the fact that the Chinese were going to enter Tibet, that was going to change the scene along our frontiers, that was going to have implications for our security. But he had a foreign policy where he felt that in the time of a Cold War, he didn't want India to be dragged into supporting either side, either the United States or the Soviet Union. He wanted India to be part of a third force in world politics. And he felt that cooperation with China, this new country, this new force that had come up along India's frontiers, this big nation, the other one being India in Asia, there was need for India and China to really open up a dialogue between each other and to come to some degree of understanding about the situation in Asia. And I think that was his foreign policy. But his frontier policy, let me say, was about not yielding an inch to China as far as our frontiers were concerned. The problem lay in the fact that when it came to Tibet, we gave up whatever rights and privileges we had in Tibet, but we did not seek an understanding simultaneously from China in regard to our common frontier.
And would you say, tell us, and especially, you know, those who are listening to this, those who are reading about this, you write a lot, and I found it fascinating, about the role that was played by India's first envoy to China. And is he, from your writing, it appears that, you know, you feel, your assessment is that a lot of the kind of miscalculation or perhaps whatever India took away at that time was because of Ambassador Panikkar, who was there at that time. Tell us more about him.
Well, I think Nehru and Panikkar had a very good understanding between themselves. And even if the rest of the Foreign Office distrusted Sardar Panikkar or, you know, felt that he was being too appeasing of the Chinese, he was somehow able to gild his dispatches in a manner that really pleased Nehru and that somehow established a direct communication with Nehru. So, yes, to that extent, I believe that Nehru listened to Sardar Panikkar, Ambassador Panikkar, and Ambassador Panikkar, once he had become envoy to Communist China, you know, if you remember, he was also envoy to Nationalist China. He was envoy to the Kuomintang before the collapse of the Nationalist regime, before the establishment of the People's Republic. But once he came to Beijing as ambassador to the People's Republic, his attitude seemed to be more, there was a degree of awe, let us say, about this new regime that had established itself, that had won the civil war against the nationalists, that was consolidating its power at a rapid pace within China's frontiers. And what he was communicating back to Nehru was, in a sense, saying that if it came to Tibet, there was very little that India could do, that the Tibetan dispensation led by the Dalai Lama and the clergy, the Buddhist clergy, was really anachronistic, that it could not face up to the force of the Chinese, the new Chinese regime. And therefore, India had come to come to terms with these realities. So that's where I believe, Panikkar's advice, in taking Panikkar's advice, perhaps Jawaharlal Nehru sort of set aside his very real reservations about the implications for India's security of China's entry into Tibet.
I wanted to ask you, as a former ambassador to China, and from reading your book, it's fascinating how so many people keep referring to China as, you know, and talk about the mind games. Some people refer to the thinking in China as cunning. How much of that is particular only to China, or is it true of negotiating any kind of tricky diplomatic relationship?
Well, in any negotiation, I think each side has to understand the other comprehensively. You have to anticipate the kind of positions that the other side is going to take. You have to be very clear about what your bottom line is. You have to be totally lucid about what you can give up and what you cannot give up. I think that applies to any set of diplomatic negotiations, whether it's the Chinese or whether it's any other country. So, yes, you're right about that. When it comes to diplomacy, negotiation is an art, even more than a science, and that one has to understand one's opponent perfectly in order to be able to master a negotiation and to come to conclusions that safeguard your interest.
Mr. I wanted to ask you, with all of this kind of scholarship that you have on China, and this book has come out, it is so relevant and so interesting right now, because sometimes I felt that, you know, the crisis and the kind of aggression that we are talking about when it comes to China, it's so relevant because of the headlines we've been reading about China in the last year and a half. Do you think what's happening right now. If you put all that we know and the history on it to what's happening right now, how would you term the talks that have been happening? There are 13th round of talks that are happening. Do you feel that things are moving somewhere, or is it yet again an instance of things being horribly misread?
Well, I don't believe we're misreading the Chinese now. We've dealt with them for over 7 decades. Many lessons have been learned. Many conclusions have been drawn. And I think we understand the terrain so much better. We understand the contours of the problem so much more clearly. So I don't believe we're losing ground on that front any longer. The fact is that we have a terribly complex territorial dispute with China. It's the longest standing land border dispute, I think, anywhere in the world. It's in terms of the territory involved, it's one of the largest disputes you can think of at this point of time. Now, what has happened along the line of actual control in eastern Ladakh and in some other areas of the border is that the Chinese have become so much more active, so much more assertive, so much more aggressive, if I may use the word. And that has entailed a drastic change in the situation along the line of actual control for India. Tensions have arisen, and most importantly, the mechanisms and the regimes and the arrangements and agreements that we had for maintaining peace and tranquility and to build confidence between the two sides have essentially broken down, which is extremely unfortunate. So India is on the right track in trying to seek through patient negotiation, de-escalation and disengagement so that the situation along the line of actual control can revert to normal so that the status quo can be restored. So we are on the right track, but it's proving complex, it's proving protracted, and it's proving very complicated. But obviously, what is the choice? I mean, wars, as I said in my book, are imperfect chisels in which to carve out peaceful tomorrows. I quoted Martin Luther King, and I think a war is an imperfect chisel, and it's not going to be able to solve anything for us. So there is no choice but to continue to seek de-escalation and to arrive at some degree of disengagement so that we are able to reduce tensions in this area. But don't forget, there is an underlying territorial border dispute between the two countries. And unless or until we're able to solve it, we will not have a permanent, lasting solution to these problems.
What makes you say that it's heading towards the right direction? Because just as an outsider, we see these statements after every round. As I said, there have been 13 rounds till now. And in fact, one of the last statements after a long time brought up had the Chinese asserting their sovereignty. So I wanted to ask you, are there signs that you see as an expert which give you optimism about these talks, which perhaps we are not seeing?
Well, I think we have to be completely dispassionate about these matters. Once you understand the complexity of the problem and the dimensions and the contours, as I said, you will understand that these issues do not get resolved overnight, that patience and perseverance are required, and you have to be completely dispassionate. I'm not saying we should be detached from questions of sovereignty, but I would use the word detachment in another context. The media, with no offense meant, tends to, the pendulum swings either towards pessimism or towards optimism. But, diplomacy is the art of the middle road, is the art of seeking solutions, not through war and conflict, but through negotiation and through peaceful discussion. So we are pursuing that path, whether it's our military commanders who are having these, long drawn out commander level meetings, or whether it's the Ministry of External Affairs, or whether it's the political leadership discussing these things with the Chinese. This is being conducted across dimensions, across disciplines, across various sectors of the policymaking establishment. And I think that's the way to go about it. That's the way we conduct diplomacy.
You don't think at some point, especially looking at this, some people feel that perhaps it's time for a political resolution because there seems to be a bit of an impasse right now. You don't agree with that?
No, I certainly do not disagree with it. I think we must seek a political solution. And our Prime Minister and the Chinese leader Xi Jinping had established a channel of communication, as you know, through the informal summits, through the various meetings they have been having over the years. Unfortunately, since the Galwan Valley incident, we haven't had that kind of direct communication. But, you know, Galwan was such a shock to the entire structure of the bilateral relationship between India and China. And this, you know, situation as we see it today was to be expected. But I think where you can understand and gauge that there is scope for optimism is the fact that we've kept the channels of communication open and that this is these matters are being discussed. But I agree with you, unless, you know, we act and we work simultaneously towards seeking a political solution of the larger problem, larger boundary question between India and China, I believe that the future, you know, is not going to be as clear as we would wish it to be.
I don't want to get into nitty-gritties, but just because so much has been said about it, when just a few months ago, the whole process of disengagement started, ma'am. At that time, there were some people who were watching and they said that we shouldn't have given up the advantage that we had by being in Kailash Heights and by retracting from there, because China certainly hasn't left some of the hotspots that they said that they would. Do you think that's true, that we shouldn't have given up that advantage?
Really, I don't think we should be getting into the nitty-gritty of it. That's not the purpose of my interview with you this evening. You know, we have to look at the, as I said, the wider dimensions of the problem. Now, first of all, you have a line of actual control between the two countries. The second point is that line of actual control has not been mutually defined between the two nations, for whatever reason. And I think a lot of the responsibility for that lies on the Chinese side, because they have been unwilling to work with us to seek that mutually agreed delineation of the line of actual control. The third point is that the Chinese have become much more assertive along that line, and they have sought to redefine that line of actual control in certain pockets, which is really what has led to the escalation of tensions between the two countries and resulted in events like what happened in Galwan, and also has contributed to the continuing standoff in areas like Gogra and other sections of the border, whether it's in the Debsang Plain also, which is, of course, a longer standing problem. But the fact is that you are dealing with a nation, with China, that has emerged, that has put decline and poverty and exploitation behind them, and is, you know, racing, trying to race to the top to be the leading power of the world. So we are dealing with a neighbor like that. The second point is there is an asymmetry of power between India and China, which is also something we have to contend with. What do we do under these circumstances? Is the solution to, you know, to take up cudgels against China and to fight till the last man in order to ensure that we are able to clear them out? Yes, that may be the ideal solution, and that may answer all our patriotic urges and all our nationalist, desires, as it were. But in a practical, real world, is that going to provide a lasting solution to these problems? It will not. So I believe that, yes, we have a serious situation today. We are dealing with a leading superpower on the global stage as a neighbor of ours. And we have to obviously stick to our guns. We have to ensure that our integrity, territorial integrity and sovereignty are assured and protected. And while we're doing that, I believe that we must ensure that the communication with this other side is kept open, because if there is any lesson to be learned from the past, is that, you know, that conflict that we fought in 1962 did not really solve anything, if you'll agree. It really didn't solve anything. Yes, it's true that everybody sees it as a Chinese betrayal and as a defeat of India. I don't believe India was defeated. I don't believe a nation like India can be really defeated. And so let's not, you know, provide these easy definitions of right and wrong and victory and defeat to what happened. We have to look to the future and understand from the past. There is much to be learned from that past in this relationship, which is why I wrote this book. And I would urge everybody to read and understand through these pages that, you know, it isn't so simple. And you can't deduce such easy conclusions as many of us are wont to do when you look at our problems with China.
Is the challenge, as you write in the book as well, the fact that, you know, whether it's in 1962 or the 50s or even now, the fact that we don't have those lines actually demarcated? I mean, everyone kept falling back to the McMahon line. But as you point out in the book, it's not clearly defined when you come to the Northeast. So is part of the solution that whenever India and China agree that they actually map it out in black and white?
Well, I haven't said that it's not clearly defined when it comes to the Northeast. I don't think I ever said that in the book. What I have said is that the McMahon line has never been recognized by China, and that the Chinese have their own views about the right of Tibet to have signed this agreement with the British Indian government. And that's a whole history that you have to understand. The fact is that we did not lose time, let us put it that way, in consolidating our position up to the McMahon line, the northeastern frontier, soon after independence in the early 50s, which we didn't do in the Aksai Chin area, as you know. But the whole terrain is very different. The terrain in eastern Ladakh is extremely different from the terrain in Arunachal Pradesh, as you know, which is the terrain in Arunachal Pradesh is much more habitable, much more richly endowed in terms of natural resources. There is vegetation, there is water. It supports human life, which is not the case in Aksai Chin, as you know. So the history tells you that it was, you know, while we moved, and thank God we moved quickly, while the Chinese were entering Tibet, we were also consolidating our administration and the extent of our presence right up to the McMahon line, which is one of the most sensible steps strategically that we took. And nobody seems to remember that today, while we're in the, you know, this whole industry of blaming Jawaharlal Nehru has grown from strength to strength without understanding the steps that were taken under his leadership and administration to consolidate that administration up to, you know, the northeastern frontier.
I think one of the diplomats, I think that it was a Chinese envoy who said in the last few months that people should focus on the relationship of trade that India and China share instead of just focusing on the boundary issue. Would you agree with that? And if so, or if you disagree with that, I mean, what about the fact that India, you know, we've part of the action that we've taken is just ban some the Chinese products and also a lot of the Chinese apps. Is that the, in retrospect now, is that the way forward as well?
Well, I, you know, just as we talk of disengagement along the line of actual control, when it comes to the economic and trade relationships that we have built up with the Chinese, and there's some huge, you know, extent of interaction that has gone on over the last few decades, and the structure and the extent of the relationship that we have in the trade and economic areas is huge with China. So it's not easy to turn the page back on that overnight. But I think what Galvan has taught us and what the fallout of Galvan has taught us and, you know, the entire impact it has had on the bilateral relationship, I think it has taught us to understand that, you know, slowly we will have to develop more resilience, we have to reduce our dependence, let us say, on the Chinese in many, many areas, in many key areas. And that is already happening, whether it's telecommunications, whether it's building more resilient supply chains in cooperation and in dialogue with other countries beyond China in the Indo-Pacific region, with our partners like Japan, within the Quad, for instance, with the ASEAN countries, Southeast Asia. Now, you know, we're looking west with this new Western Quad that we are talking of with the UAE and with the United States and with Israel. So India, I believe, is on the right track in seeking to reduce dependence on China. I think the Chinese leadership or the policymaking establishment tends to come up with these boilerplate recommendations that, you know, focus on trade, forget about what is happening on the border. So it's not easy, you know, to follow such formulaic, sort of very, very mechanical, let's say, solutions to what we face in the India-China relationship today. I think we cannot obviously ignore or disregard the situation along the border. We have to seek to resolve it through protracted dialogue, through negotiation, through these meetings that are going on. And at the same time, this process of lowering and reducing our dependence on China and so many things, whether it's the APIs, the advanced pharmaceutical ingredients, for instance, whether it's electronic components, whether it's telecom equipment, you name it. I think this has been, you know, it's a wide awake moment for us today when we've come to realize that that kind of dependence does not serve India's strategic interest. And we have to seek to develop alternate means of ensuring that we are much more resilient and much more able to withstand these shocks in the future.
So that means in the coming few years, and especially with the kind of realignment that we're seeing, especially with the Biden administration, that this kind of antagonism, or at least this competition, is here to stay.
Yes, I think, for a lot of countries, I think the rise and emergence of China, the way China is straddling the global stage today, the kind of reverberations that are being felt all around, and they're, you know, reverberations that are tending to be causing a lot of turbulence in the environment. I think for a lot of countries, we have to not only understand what the implications of the rise of China, what the emergence of China should mean for us. It's also a time, I believe, to develop new alignments, new coalitions of the willing, as it's called, and new patterns and habits of cooperation with many other of our partners, particularly our democratic partners in the region and in other parts of the world. So this is really a time for much more creativity, much less risk aversion, I would say, when it comes to developing new coalitions and new alignments. So for India particularly, because we do live in a very difficult neighborhood today.
Nirupama Rao Menon, thank you so much for speaking with us. And to everyone, I just want to say that her book, The Fractured Himalayas, is fast-paced. It really gives you a lot of background in a manner which is so interesting, and I recommend it for everyone. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sunetra. Thank you. Bye.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HD Smartcast. HD Smartcast.